This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, so that means it's time for our Week in Review. We are covering a lot of things this week, from vaping to impeachment. But let's start with Harvard. A federal judge ruled this week that Harvard University does not illegally discriminate against Asian Americans in its admissions process. Many Harvard officials, students, and proponents of affirmative action applauded the decision, like Amber Ashley James, who recently graduated from Harvard's law and business schools.
I hope that this ruling is an indication to people that race and diversity and inclusivity on campus are aspects of the college experience that benefit everybody.
But others criticized the ruling, saying the judge disregarded evidence showing Harvard discriminated against Asian applicants in certain key areas. Here's Ilya Shapiro, the director of the Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute.
At the end of the day, I think it's hard to avoid the conclusion that the court here simply wasn't prepared to end racial preferences, regardless of what the evidence showed.
So let's dive in. With us in Studio 3 is Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion page. Welcome back, Renee.
Thank you.
Also with us this week is Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, welcome back too.
Thank you.
And you, call us. What do you make of the Harvard admissions case? Did the judge make the right choice? Or do you think the ruling exposes problems in how race is considered in college admissions? Call us. You can call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or send us a tweet at Radio Boston. All right, Renee, what's your reaction to the ruling?
Well, you know, you could practically hear the sighs of relief coming all the way from Cambridge and from other elite institutions of higher learning. It is a victory for Harvard. It's a victory for affirmative action and for the value of diversity in higher education. But I have to say I have a couple of caveats.
Go for it.
The first one being that we haven't heard the last of this. I think the plaintiffs are clear that they want to appeal this perhaps all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has a very different complexion than it did the last time affirmative action was heard, which was way back in 2003. So that's one thing. Also, the really interesting aspect of this case to me is what the discovery revealed, what was revealed through the trial, which was, you know, sort of a confirmation of what a lot of us already think, but there was some pretty stark data to prove it, which is that the almost majority of white students at Harvard are either the children of donors or of legacies or athletes or the children of faculty. So just perpetuating the privilege that a lot of people have concerns about in terms of trying to build a diverse pool.
Yeah. So, Renee, actually, let's talk for a second longer. Joe, I'm going to turn to you on this about legacies, athletes, children of donors and employees. Here's Raul Fernandez. He's a lecturer and the Associate Dean for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at Boston University, Wheelock College of Education.
Recruited athletes, folks that were legacies, deans and director on the deans and directors list, and also the children of faculty and staff, while they were only 5% of applicants, they accounted for 30% of admitted students. If you're looking for where the room is to be a little bit more liberal in applications, you want to look at that 30%, not the very small percent of Black and Hispanic students that are being admitted to Harvard every year.
So, Joe, did the case focus on the wrong thing?
Well, I think the case was limited in that dealing with affirmative action, it didn't really deal with that part of the argument is whether you know kids of donors and things like that are getting in.
No,
everybody knows that this has been going on for forever at Harvard and other Ivy League institutions and other institutions probably. So it was no big shock. But I do think for those who are declaring victory on this, I agree with Renee that it's a little early to be celebrating because I have two words for those people celebrating: Brett Kavanaugh. He's the new Supreme Court justice. He replaced Anthony Kennedy, who wrote the last decision on affirmative action and who is now gone. So Brett Kavanaugh is not going to side with affirmative action supporters. I can guarantee that.
All right, let's take a call. George from Newburyport's on the line. What do you have to say, George?
My point is this. We have a lot to go a lot further than just improved access to higher education. We have to do reparations. We have to solve income inequality, we can't make any progress if we keep fighting about this endlessly.
Thanks for that, George. And if you want to add your voice to George's, call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. All right, so Renee, we may have affirmative action continuing to be challenged all the way up to the Supreme Court, but we got Joe saying, we're not even going far enough. What do you think?
Well, I think that one thing that suggests to me is something we also know, which is the inequities in higher education begin in our educational system in this country begin long before people are writing their college applications, right? The wealthier and predominantly white students in this country, and I'm talking about grade school students, have so many more advantages to start with. You know, they have enrichment programs and they can hire coaches to help them with their SATs and so on. And these are things that we need to address. I mean, I guess I would agree to that extent with George. These are things that we need to address quite apart from whatever the elite universities or any university is trying to do to remedy that imbalance.
So you can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK if you want to join the conversation. Danny from Revere, you're on the line.
Yes, I'd like to make a comment. I worked for higher ed just for one day because I found out that they had a history at that time very deep in apartheid. And I feel as if that they can't be trusted because they have a relationship with the state of Massachusetts where we have one of the most diabolical genocidal flags in the history of the world.
So you mean the state flag you don't like, Danny? Let me keep you on that for a second. Are you saying you don't like the state flag?
It's not that I don't like it. I've been to court four times over it. And I believe that the Native leadership has complained so many times to Massachusetts and indirectly to Harvard to change the racist symbol that they have hanging over their people.
Okay, thanks for that, Danny. All right, so what I'm hearing from our callers, Joe Battenfeld, is this tension between, we're talking about a case of one university, but it echoes out into a larger set of tensions around the history of the state, around racial injustice. How do we situate the Harvard admissions case in this larger landscape?
Well, I think we can put it in the middle of the discussion. And I mean, this has become a politically charged debate for a long time. Affirmative action has. And so much the fact that we don't even use affirmative action really so much as a term anymore. Now it's what, race-based admissions.
Race-based admissions.
Yeah. So, but I mean, people are divided on this. There are people, a lot of people out there who believe that, in fact, affirmative action or race-based admissions do discriminate against certain people, and in this case, Asian Americans at Harvard. And there was some evidence in the case. I hate to tell the judge, there was some evidence in the case that bolstered that. And I think that evidence is going to be used in an appeal down the line.
And that was evidence, just to help our listeners understand, that was some evidence that Asian American applicants suffered from essentially implicit bias in the personality scores. Renee, the judge did say that, you know, this was not a perfect process and gave some merit to that despite the finding. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that we're going to see Harvard and many other institutions follow suit to really pump up their implicit bias training of their college admission staff and faculty and others, because I think we did find that there were sort of cultural markers that disadvantaged the Asian students, that we discovered that in this case as well. And I think that's a problem. But I do think that we also need to focus on these other, the legacies and the other advantaged students who probably are more, the odds are that that the aggrieved whites or Asians who felt like their spots were being taken by minority students, the odds are just as good that they were taken by other white students of privilege. So, you can't blame affirmative action for that.
All right, let's take one more call on this subject. Believe me, there will be plenty of time to call out a lot of things. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ryan from South Boston, go ahead.
The issue of class-based admissions was not addressed, obviously, in this decision, but it is very, very much a part of the character of the campus and efforts to provide people with opportunities who come from disadvantaged backgrounds. So class-based admissions, regardless of race.
So when you say class-based, Ryan, I just want to, you mean socioeconomic, is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
Thanks for the call. Joe Battenfeld, what's your reaction
there,
to that?
In fact, there are some experiments going on now to use socioeconomic factors in admissions processes instead of race. In other words, use, you know, go and look and see how disadvantaged a student may have been and what a student may have overcome, what adversity a student may have overcome to get in to apply for that. So I think those are fruitful and that those should be explored further.
All right. So lots to talk about here. I want to move on to some other significant legal cases that came up in the news this week. In Philadelphia, a federal judge ruled a nonprofit could move ahead with building a supervised consumption site, a move that many in Boston were watching closely. Here's Cambridge Mayor Mark McGovern telling us he'd also like to open a facility where people could use illegal opioids under medical supervision.
The court has spoken, and as with many issues that are controversial or are social justice issues, you need court intervention sometimes to give the green light, and they have done that in this case.
Then on a separate front, three vape shops and a national vaping group are suing Governor Charlie Baker over his four-month ban on vaping products in Massachusetts. Here's Attorney Craig Rourke.
There's a strong body of case law that supports our Commerce Clause claims, our First Amendment claims, our regulatory taking claims, and our Contracts Clause claims.
And because it's been a busy week, the state's highest court also threw out the manslaughter conviction of a UMass Amherst student who supplied heroin to a classmate who then died from an overdose with that heroin. Some prosecutors are not happy.
This decision to us seems to be divorced from reality.
Okay, so call us on these subjects. What do you think of these cases? What are the implications for the Commonwealth? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So Joe Battenfeld, a judge in Philadelphia, rules that a supervised consumption site doesn't violate federal drug laws. Does that make a strong case for doing them here in the Boston area?
Well, unfortunately, they have the U.S. attorney here in Massachusetts saying otherwise, that he is actually going to prevent those any places from opening, any supervised drug injection sites from opening. So that is a big problem there. And that's what Charlie Baker has cited that as part of his opposition to what to opening those. So I think that's a huge problem going forward, no, regardless of what the court said.
Yes. So U.S. Massachusetts Attorney Andrew Lelling has said repeatedly, hey, you try to do this here, I'm going to come after you. And Renee, one of the things that we learned from Judge Nancy Gertner when she was on our show earlier this week is that the federal jurisdiction in Philadelphia is different than the one for here in Massachusetts. So just because that court said it's okay doesn't mean it would be here. Are we going to have a legal challenge if people want supervised consumption sites, or do you wait until the law changes?
Well, it sounds to me like we're headed for a similar kind of legal case, you know, a trial or with a court involved here in Massachusetts as well. Because Andrew Lelling, who is no shrinking violet, you know, he's a very powerful U.S. attorney, has said that he will continue to oppose these safe injection sites despite the Philadelphia ruling. So I think, and there are many people, not just the mayor of Cambridge, but the mayor of Somerville and others who want to experiment with these safe sites in a kind of do no harm, you know, drug treatment approach. And, you know, so I think we're going to end up with that kind of clash getting before a court here as well.
Let's go to the phones. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dave from Dedham on line two. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, about the safe sites, I heard you with the mayor and you were talking about the legalities of it, but no one's talked about the logistics. For example, are the police going to enforce drug sales around the injection sites? What happens to the people who use the drugs afterwards? They're not going to go to work. Finally, are they going to check the safety of the drugs before they're injected? And finally, if someone doesn't have drugs, are we going to provide them?
So great questions from Dave from Dedham. Joe Battenfeld, how much thinking about how to structure something like this does a community have to do? How important is that dimension? And do you think we're capable of coordinating and coming up with those policies in Greater Boston?
I mean, you may be capable of doing that in a municipality like Cambridge, for instance, that, you know, but it would have to take a lot of coordination from the agencies and the police and the federal authorities to get this thing done. I mean, it's not going to be easy task. And those are good questions, that the listener raised that haven't been answered yet. And until they do, I think they should hold back on these injection sites.
So to that point, we spoke with Boston City Councilor Anissa Asaibi-George about supervised injection sites after she toured some in Canada. She told us that she thinks they're the wrong focus because of the complexity and cost with getting them off the ground.
We know that people are dying today in our city. There are pieces of this that we can do today. We think about the millions of dollars that it costs to open one site. I want to invest those in actions that we can do today and tomorrow to save lives.
So, Renee, I think in part in those costs, she's talking about legal challenges. You know, even the federal prosecutor who brought the case in Philadelphia is unhappy with the judge's ruling there. You know this is going to be complicated on several levels. Does she have a point? Focus on naloxone. Focus on needle exchange. Don't take on something this unprecedented and controversial.
Well, you know, I mean, somebody always has to go first in these developments. So I'm not sure that just because it's complicated, we shouldn't do it. One of the advantages potentially of the safe injection sites, similar to the needle exchange programs, which have proved really helpful, is that it helps to identify addicts and get them into treatment. And, you know, I think that the caller raised excellent questions, but I think those questions are being asked by folks who would be in charge of establishing these sites as well. And of course, there would be testing of the drugs, and there would be an opportunity to get the users into treatment. And the question then becomes for me, do we have the resources to provide the treatment that the people are looking for? This is something that, you know, treatment on demand is an issue that this state has never been able to fully address. And there's never enough beds for people who want to get clean. And, that's an even larger and more expensive question than what's being raised here.
Okay, so a lot going on there. We're undoubtedly going to continue over time to have dialogues about supervised consumption sites. I do want to get to vaping before we take a break. Earlier today, a federal judge denied a temporary restraining order plea. I probably got that legally wrong, but hopefully in lay terms you understand what I mean, to lift Massachusetts' short-term four-month ban on vaping. That's in a case filed by Vapor Technology Association. There's been another case federally brought by three local stores. Here is Koram Aga, who's the owner of the Vapor Zone. And this is what he said after the hearing today.
I might have to go out of business because, you know, we've signed permanent lease, permanent meaning in leasing terms is 3 to 5 years. But we have to pay the rent to the landlord and we can't even sell anything.
Okay, but at the same time, we also know there have been 111 reported vaping-related injuries to the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. At this point, 5 have been confirmed, 5 are considered probable. Joe, how should citizens think about the tension between the loss of income and business of vaping stores now with this ban versus the public health unknowns that led the governor to argue we needed to do it?
Well, I think the governor was mistaken. I think he overreacted. I don't think what most people are dying from and getting sick from are illicit purchases of these products, not something you buy, you know, legitimately. And, you know, I don't think he thought through it. I think businesses are being hurt. They're going to shut down. And it's going to be a really hard thing for people to recover from. You can't, if you sell those products, you can't recover and then just say, oh, I'm going to open after they decide in 6 months to let vaping stand again, you know, you're going to close.
So just to build on Joe's point, Renee, it sounds like at the CDC level, we don't necessarily know if all of the illnesses are coming from illegal products or if some of them are coming from legally regulated products. Seems to be a lot of confusion there. And yet there have been people who, because the businesses were legal, invested their livelihoods, and people who rely, for example, on vaping instead of cigarettes. That's one of the other public health arguments in favor of vaping.
And medical
vaping.
Marijuana as
right.
Well.
How do you comb something this complicated out responsibly?
Well, I mean, I think those questions actually suggest that the governor was right to put a temporary moratorium on the sales of these products. And, you know, he's not the only one doing this. The Trump administration itself has been saying that they're going to ban flavored, vaping products. And
flavored e-cigarettes have been banned in a number of states.
Number of places. And Walmart's not selling them anymore. You know, this is something that you know, the governor was absolutely ahead of the curve, or you would say he was a little bit in the vanguard of this, and maybe he did act precipitously, but he's not alone in these concerns. What I think is, I do sympathize with the businesses, and what I think was unfortunate in the governor's decision was to act to make it, you know, effective immediately. There was no warning for the businesses at all that this was coming down the pike, and I think that there they have a legitimate complaint.
All right, I'd like to spend about 1 minute on one more legal case before we take a break. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court yesterday threw out the manslaughter conviction of a student who gave another student heroin, which led to that student's death. The justices said prosecutors failed to prove that Jesse Carrillo, who sold the heroin, knew his conduct would have led to an overdose or death. Joe, what do you make of the decision?
It's ridiculous. How do you not know that it's going to lead to an overdose or death? I mean, maybe, you know, I don't know what particular evidence that they had that the judge is talking about. But it just common sense would say that a dealer knows what's going to happen when he's selling these drugs.
Here's the prosecution essentially backing up your point. This is Stephen Gagne, the first assistant Northwestern district attorney.
This decision to us seems to be divorced from reality. The court seems to think that you have to either have an overdose or a near overdose before heroin distribution can rise to the level of manslaughter. You know, we have a different interpretation of the law.
Okay, so Renee, on the other hand, so there's a strong argument there. On the other hand, were this case to have gone forward, been upheld, it would have essentially said that if you're dealing, it would essentially have said that if you're dealing, you're guilty of what, manslaughter? That would put a lot of people trapped in the drug crisis at risk of a different kind of criminal prosecution.
Yeah. As I understand this case, the defendant actually bought the heroin for his own use. And then shared it with his roommate.
Yeah, and that's an important clarification. They're telling me, hey, the defense was that he was not a dealer, that he shared the drugs.
He bought the heroin for his own use. And so if he was, intent on manslaughter, maybe he was intent on manslaughter of himself. I mean, you know, that mitigates somewhat the argument that this was an intentional, or I mean, I guess manslaughter is not premeditated, but there was an intentional cause of harm here, of death here. And I do think it complicates things to suggest that anybody who uses heroin or shares it with their friends or roommates is, and then there is a terrible tragic overdose, is guilty of manslaughter. There are drug laws. There are other ways to prosecute this young man besides charging him with manslaughter.
Okay, so we're going to take a break. Listeners, hang on with us, because when we come back, we're going to talk impeachment, and we want you to call and share your thoughts at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. For now, Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. I hope you're going to hang around.
I'll hang out.
And Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald. Stay with us.
I will.
And you, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston and our Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Dearing. Still with us here in Studio 3 is Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion page. Renee, thanks for sticking with us.
Hiya.
Also with us still is Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, we're so glad you're still with us.
It's great to be here.
Okay, so we're going to turn now to the story that seems to be consuming the country, the impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump. What was once a slow drip of news now feels more like a fire hose, with a release of text messages last night showing envoys uncomfortable with President Trump's attempts to get Ukraine to investigate his political rival, Joe Biden. Trump defended himself outside the White House today, insisting one of the State Department text messages said there was no quid pro quo.
He said, by the way, there's no quid pro quo, and there isn't. Now, for Biden, there would be, but listen to this. There is no pro quo. And that was the text message that I saw, and that nullified everything.
House committees are continuing their investigations into the president's actions, with the Inspector General for the Intelligence Community testifying behind closed doors on Capitol Hill today. So what do you think? What do you think about the inquiry? Is this a case of high crimes and misdemeanors? Is it a witch hunt? Is it something in between? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Okay, first, broadly, how are each of you thinking about, I think, what is arguably at least a moment in our nation's history?
Yeah, we were talking before with Renee. They have now all the news sites, Washington Post and others, have live updates on impeachment, like it's a live event.
Right, like
happening
it's the Olympics.
Now. Yeah, yeah, like the Olympics or a hearing or something like that. So that's how fast news is coming out. And, you know, we had to look and check our phones before we came out here to see what the last thing that Trump said was. So, you know, this thing is so fast moving. And I do think that Trump knows that people are watching everything he says, and he does things to provoke the media and to get them to report on things that he wants them us to report on.
Sounds like it's working because we're talking about it.
Yeah.
What do you think, Renee?
Well, you know, yes, I think it's a historic moment in our country. I think there's a lot of risks on both sides here. But I think, you know, just in broad strokes, you know, I've heard a lot about how this could backfire on the Democrats, you know, how the impeachment inquiry could just fire up the president's base, or it could drag Biden down with it, or it could, you know, sort of turn off the average American who's sick of all of the drama. And I think all of that's true. But to me, what that says is how serious this must be as a threat to our, you know, Constitution and our democracy for somebody as savvy a strategist as Nancy Pelosi to pursue this case despite the risks.
All right. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got a couple callers who I think kind of represent point counterpoint. So I want to invite them both. First, Steve from Dorchester. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, Steve. Thanks. Go ahead.
Good. Okay. I think this is a farce, very honestly, as far as Trump's impeachment. I think it's showing that the Democrats are on a witch hunt, as he says. And I believe it will backfire. And I hope it does.
Thanks for that, Steve. I'm going to get a counterpoint from Joe in Reading. Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, I was always against impeachment because I thought that his rabid followers would say it was a coup rather than a really bad election campaign. But what he's doing is just ridiculous. And then this talk about putting alligators in the moat at the southern border, shooting immigrants in the leg. The guy lies so much. How can we possibly believe this hilarious idea that he's against corruption? Never been for corruption. His whole family is corrupt. And all of a sudden he's for corruption, but only with Joe Biden.
All right. Thanks for that, Joe. So, Joe Battenfeld, there's your point counterpoint right there. We invited America to have a conversation with
them,
and they are. How do we make a way forward as a country in this tension?
I think by following the rules of that they've set down now, that they're doing the inquiry. But I do think it's a risk for Democrats to shoot too far and too wide on this. They should really be focusing on impeachable offenses and not every little thing that they think should be prosecuted, because it's going to muddle the case. And it's really going to, I think more Americans will say, this is getting ridiculous. Let's get bound to a real business instead of doing impeachment. So I think the risks are that they shoot too far and too wide. You know, the Ukraine thing is perfect for the Democrats because it's easy to understand. It's not something that's complex at all. You know, Trump asked them to investigate. So, you know, pursuing that, I think, you know, it is probably a better idea than going after every little thing and the emoluments clause and every little thing that's going under the sun.
So, Renee Loth, let's talk about timing, too. Here's House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff.
We'll have to decide whether to litigate or how to litigate. We're not fooling around here, though. We don't want this to drag on months and months and months, which appears to be the administration's strategy.
Okay, so we've been hearing we're exhausted, we're tired, this is internecine, it's small details, Congress has work to do, and not for nothing, months and months and months would put the country smack in the middle of a presidential election, which ethically complicates this tremendously. So is there any way to do this that's not scorched earth because of the time and the drag out it will take?
No, there's no way to do it. That's not going to be a scorched earth situation. I mean, I think that you can just say the timing is bad. We have this president who, you know, has just shredded every norm of, you know, behavior and is not shy about, you know, going to the he's sort of like a cornered animal, you know, and he's not shy about lashing out. The Democrats, you know, have a very difficult time of it because they have to worry about their own presidential hopes. You know, it's a very delicate situation. It's going to be a very exhausting period. But I have to say that it's quite something to see the president of the United States on the White House lawn, as he did this week, admit brazenly to precisely what the House investigators are trying to establish, to wit, I am soliciting publicly help from foreign governments, there's two now,
China,
China
on
and
the
Ukraine,
lawn and Ukraine before.
To interfere with our elections for my own personal political gain, to investigate a rival. I mean, it couldn't be any clearer than that. I think what the president is trying to do, and you talked about muddling the situation, what he's trying to do is normalize these corrupt acts and gaslight the American public into thinking that it's no big deal. Because if it were a big deal, why wouldn't I be trying to hide it? Of course, they did try to hide it initially, but now he's saying, oh, yeah, you know, I'm asking for help from foreign governments. What's the big deal?
Okay. So I want to take a call in a second, but before I do that, I just want to give Joe Battenfeld a chance to respond to you. Go ahead, Joe.
No, I do agree that that's what he's doing. He's trying to normalize it. And I think it's a smart strategy on his part to do that, to talk about it and also talk about the Bidens, get people talking about Hunter Biden, because there are some questions about what Hunter Biden was doing for $50,000 a month. And so, you know, I think it's smart for him to do that.
Okay, the lines are full. So what I'm going to do is take a few caller voices here. Brad from Marblehead, go right ahead.
I have two things I'd like to say. One, I don't understand why the media keeps calling it an impeachment inquiry when the statute's pretty clear they have to have a floor vote for that to be the case. Second, it doesn't seem to me like the president's committed any crime that is actually prosecutable. No prosecutor I know of would be able to argue that in court. So what is the point of this? It seems maybe it's just opposition research.
Okay. So let's add another voice to that. Connor from Cambridge, you go ahead. Build on that.
Hi. I just like to point out that a common line of the Trump defenders is that he needs to have committed high crimes or misdemeanors, right? There's that phrase, high crimes. And
yes, it says treason, bribery, high crimes, and misdemeanors. Yep.
Yeah. And I think there's this misconception that high crimes means serious crimes, like treason. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think high crimes actually refers to the office and not the level of the crime.
Okay, so great clarification there, Connor. Thank you. And we had a couple of pieces of clarification from those two callers around process. Does the floor, House floor, need to vote on an impeachment inquiry before they can launch it? What does high crimes mean? Renee, Joe, whichever one wants to jump in first. Procedurally, this is really confusing, but people have busy lives. So how are citizens supposed to stay informed and keep track of what this process is supposed to be?
I mean, I do believe there doesn't have to be a formal vote. Is that right?
To launch an impeachment inquiry alone. No,
but it's been done before, and it's probably the Democrats do not want to do that because they do not want to put some of these vulnerable House members on record of voting for impeachment or not. So they're going to do everything they can to avoid that.
And first, they have to assemble the articles of impeachment, which include what the actual complaints are, obstruction or, you know, soliciting foreign help in the elections, that kind of thing. And then there's a vote on that. And that'll be a difficult vote for the House members before it can proceed to the Senate. And many won't want to take a vote when they believe that the Senate will not, convict after the impeachment. There's a conviction vote. The Senate, controlled by the Republicans, will not convict probably. So a lot of House members will be dicey about wanting to take that vote when what will be the ultimate consequence. And I think the president knows that he has the ultimate backing, at least so far, of the Republicans in the Senate.
Okay, so there is a lot to watch there, as there has been in almost everything we've covered today. It's been a big week. I do want to make sure to leave a little bit of time for our hubbubs. Those are the brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Joe, why don't you go first? What's your hubbub?
Well, the Newseum, which is a museum dedicated to news, is shutting its doors.
It makes me so sad. Yeah, I love the museum.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem was they charged $25 for people to get in. Everything is free, and all the museums are free
in
Washington. Yeah, so that was one of the problems. And they built this huge building, you know, that was probably too expensive for what they were trying to do. But it is a shame because there are some really important exhibits about there about journalists who've died covering stories and 9/11 and other things that are important in there. I hope they find a place to put them now.
Have you been to the museum, Joe?
I went a long time ago, yeah.
What's one thing you saw that you still remember?
There was an exhibit. Somebody, I can't remember the journalist's name, but he was a journalist who was investigating mob crime. And
in
his
California.
Car blew up. His car blew up. And so his car is actually in the museum, the one that blew up.
Yeah, I remember that, too. It was really striking.
Yeah.
All right, Renee, how about you?
Well, my hubbub is a shout out to the Boston artist Pat Falco, whose latest installation is on view on Northern Avenue in the Seaport District. It is a mock-up of a traditional Boston triple-decker, complete with vinyl siding. And it provides a kind of stark statement about Boston's housing inequality issues, sitting there amid the, you know, million-dollar condos and the construction cranes of the Seaport District. And it also raises questions about how the Seaport might have developed, you know, i.e. into an actual neighborhood with real people and schools and kids and hardware stores, which instead of the playground for the rich that it is today. I wanted to also give a double shout out to the sponsors of this piece of artwork, which is an organization called Now and There, which is a really great Boston public art incubator that supports and has brought to Boston many really high quality and very provocative works of public art to a city that has not always been that welcoming to them. So just go out there and see this. It's on Northern Avenue. It's called Mock, and it's going to be up until the end of November.
All right. And for me, it turns out we're in the middle of a two-week-long 15th anniversary, which was the 15th anniversary of a visit by a 14-foot great white shark in a shallow inlet just off Nishan Island. I found this through the Boston Globe. At that time, great white shark sightings were extremely rare on the Cape. Here's Greg Skomel, who is a senior biologist and shark expert at the Division of Marine Fisheries. He got to tag his first shark for his research 15 years ago with that shark, and he reflects on what came next.
It was 5 years later that we tagged our second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth white sharks in 2009. And then here we are 10 years after that, and we've tagged close to 200. We've come a long way since then, and we've learned a heck of a lot about this species. But that was really our first indication of what was to be.
And that's Greg Skomel reflecting in an oral history that the Boston Globe did. The video footage on this is incredible. You've got rocks, and people are standing there, and like 5 feet away is a 14-foot-long great white shark, and it really does in some ways mark the beginning of the Cape's experience with great whites. All right, so that is Week in Review. Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion page. Thanks for joining us today.
It was great. Thank you.
And Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. There is more ahead. We're going to talk about the outdoors. We'll run through the best hikes for your weekend. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.